again.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Desch, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame and a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study. He's a member of the editorial board and associate editor of International Security and served as editor-in-chief of Security Studies. Before joining the faculty at Notre Dame, Professor Desch was a founding director of the Scowcroft Institute for International Affairs, and he was the first holder of the Robert M. Gates Chair in Intelligence and National Security Decision-Making at the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. He has an article at Foreign Affairs, Bibi's Chutzpah, The Prime Minister Crosses a Red Line. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Desch.
Glad to be here.
And we don't know whether the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, is going to cross the ultimate red line before the elections, as he often has in effect threatened to do. Since you've worked with Brent Scowcroft and Robert Gates, I'm sure you're aware of the study that Brent Scowcroft and Brzezinski and Tom Pickering and a group of fairly stellar U.S. national security officials.
That was a cast of thousands.
Right. Well, they put this study together, the cost-benefit analysis of what a strike on Iran would mean. My understanding from that group is that they're not entirely sure that Netanyahu's not going to strike Iran before the elections.
I think that there is good reason to be concerned because, Netanyahu is continually making threatening noise, and it seems, highly likely that, he's going to take some action at some point, whether it's before the election or not. I don't know at this point, but it is quite worrisome.
Well, as you've pointed out, though, in your article in Foreign Affairs, Michael Desch, he has already inserted himself in the United States elections. I mean, you could argue that it's no question that the biggest donor so far to Mitt Romney's campaign is Sheldon Adelson, who is undeniably incredibly close to Netanyahu, having actually established a newspaper in Israel entirely devoted to promoting Netanyahu and his policies. This newspaper has become so successful because it's given away free that it's pretty much put a very storied Israeli newspaper out of business. That's not concrete proof. And then you can add to that that John McLaughlin, a former Likud official, is running a PAC down in Florida that is running ads against Obama, suggesting he's thrown Israel under the bus. And
right.
There's no question that they are reflecting Netanyahu's views.
Right. Well, as you said, there are really two red lines out there. One is the red line of whether Israel attacks Iran, but the other red line is getting deeply involved in American domestic politics. And Netanyahu hasn't yet crossed the first, but in my opinion, he's well over the second.
So does this make other Israeli officials nervous? I noticed that the leader of the opposition in the Knesset the other day said, to Netanyahu, are you determined to take down the Ahmadinejad government or the Obama government?
Well, it's interesting because the debate in the United States really glosses over how polarized things are in Israel on the whole question of how to deal with Iran and also Prime Minister Netanyahu's, willingness really to push the edge of the envelope. And it's not just the opposition. You have, a raft of retired generals and, former senior intelligence people who are, coming out quite strongly against Netanyahu's sort of apocalyptic rhetoric. And you've also got a lot of concern, and this is really, one of the big issues in Israel. No Israeli prime minister can be seen to be threatening the relationship with the United States. And I think since Yitzhak Shamir and the loan guarantees in 1992, you haven't seen anybody go as far over the line as Netanyahu has. And this makes lots of Israelis nervous, and it's also making a lot of Israel's supporters in the United States quite uncomfortable as well. Hence the letter from California Senator Barbara Boxer, very pointedly reminding Netanyahu of all the United States does for Israel, including the Obama administration in that.
Well, Michael Desch, again, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame and a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study. He's a member of the editorial board and associate editor of International Security and served as editor-in-chief of Security Studies. He has an article at Foreign Affairs, BB's Chutzpah, The Prime Minister Crosses a Red Line. Well, just following Barbara Boxer's letter to Bibi Netanyahu, let's talk a little bit about what the United States does do for Israel. They've provided more than $160 billion in bilateral aid since 1948, most of it's military. 60% of all U.S. aid to foreign militaries goes to Israel, which constitutes about 20% of Israel's annual military spending. And the U.S. has, the last few presidents have gone overboard, if you will, in guaranteeing Israel's security. And on top of all of this largesse, in 2007, George W. Bush made a 10-year commitment to provide $30 billion in military extra in military aid to Israel, which Obama has continued to do. And the United States has just deployed its most advanced X-band radar system, which is manned by U.S. personnel in Israel, which would pick up, I think, if a dove takes off in Tehran, I think they can see it, you know.
Well, it hardly sounds like we're throwing Israel under the bus. And yet, you wouldn't know that listening to Governor Romney or seeing these ads in Florida.
So what do you think Obama can do about this, since he's on the receiving end of what's essentially the big lie that he's thrown Israel under the bus when he's done everything he can short of go to war? And, you know, we've already had an unnecessary undeclared war against Iraq, and you don't have to be a genius to notice that Iran won the Iraq war. I mean, we can't even get the Iraqis, who we put in power, to stop the overflight of Iranian aircraft going into Syria supplying the Assad regime. So, you know, if that's the neoconservative idea of a necessary war, another necessary war will put us out of business, won't it?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, there is nobody in the national security community that thinks that a military strike against Iran is anything other than a stopgap. And clearly the American public has little stomach for a third major war in the Islamic world. So I, you know, apropos of your question, Ian, President Obama has to walk something of a fine line. I think he does have to respond to the throwing Israel under the bus charge, and surrogates like Senator Boxer, I think, can do that very effectively. On the other hand, I don't think he wants to give away the store. We don't want to be in a position where even a unilateral Israeli strike drags us into a conflict. And likewise, we don't want to paint ourselves into a corner in terms of hewing so closely to the Likud line on issues in the Middle East. And I think a lot of the crisis that you know is in Netanyahu's mind is not just about the development of the Iranian nuclear program, but it's also thinking ahead. If President Obama is elected to a second term, and when he, you know, no longer has the constraints of re-election, and when he's thinking, very much about his legacy, a big legacy act would be to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and establish a Palestinian state. And I'm sure that in the back of Netanyahu and a lot of his coalition members' minds is a concern that if it was that hard to deal with Obama facing re-election, what happens if he wins?
Well, it would seem, Michael Desch, that there's a fairly transparent tactic going on here on Netanyahu's part, which is to change the subject from the Palestinians to Iran. And he's effectively done that. Here we are talking about a possible strike on Iran. And frankly, that's been pretty much obsessing the Israeli press for the last year. So the Palestinians are almost invisible. I noticed that the new Egyptian leader in a New York Times interview on Sunday, ahead of his trip to the UN, where he's expected to give a speech, that he's calling for fair and equitable treatment of the Palestinians. So one assumes that he's got a certain amount of leverage over Israel, given the treaty and how unpopular it is in Egypt. Do you think that there's going to be a fairly concerted pressure here from Egypt, not to mention the United States?
Yeah, when you think back of the remarkable record of the Egyptians since 1979 in holding up their end of the Camp David Accords in the face of things like the First Lebanon War and the Two Intifadas and the Second Lebanon War and the Gaza incursion, you know, the Israelis have really enjoyed a lot of security on that southern flank, which, you know, previously had been the main threat that they faced. And that was a function of the fact that there was a pro-American government in power that was, pliable, and the United States was willing to push them to maintain the treaty. The Morsi government has drawn a line in the sand, as it were, on a number of issues. And one of the issues is the one you pointed to, the unfinished business of the Camp David Accords. I also think that, President Obama, in his heart of hearts, independent of what the Egyptians would like on this score, would also love to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and produce a Palestinian state.
Well, it's actually in the Camp David Accords, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and it's been reiterated by every presidential administration, including that of George W. Bush, since then.
So, meanwhile, the settlements are growing apace, and now you have in Europe and in some circles of the American left this idea of a one-state solution, which I can't quite get my head around. It seems sort of soporific, but there's a lot of pressure basically saying that this process, this so-called peace process, is not about peace. It's about a process. And
the eternal process.
Yeah, and you get the impression that most people are starting to figure out that the Likud in particular aren't entirely serious about peace.
I think not entirely serious is an understatement. I think, you know, Likud and the larger, Greater Israel coalition that undergirds the Netanyahu government, rejects the two-state solution. And ironically, de facto, what the status quo is producing is a one-state solution. Now, I guess I'm with you. Maybe I'm an old dinosaur, but, you know, my view is that the only long-term settlement that ensures stability in the region and also ensures that Israel remains a democratic and a Jewish state is a two-state solution with, a viable Palestinian state for the Palestinians. But the Greater Israel crowd is so committed or beholden to the settlement enterprise they're in effect rejecting the two-state solution and continuing with policies that are going to ultimately result in the one-state solution. So ironically, you have, the left and the right sort of converging on a policy that down the road is going to be a disaster.
And Michael Desch, it's not unfair to tie Mitt Romney to the right-wing Israeli position here, because he's made it pretty clear, particularly in that surreptitious tape from the fundraiser down in Florida in May, that he pretty much dismisses the Palestinians, that they're not serious about peace, which is another way to saying that buying into the idea that they're just a bunch of terrorists.
Right. Well, I think that there are, you know, two things. One, you know, the issue that's getting a lot of attention is Netanyahu's longstanding personal relationship with former Governor Romney. And I think that matters a little bit. But I think the bigger issue has been the development since the late 1970s of larger political links between the Republican Party and Likud and, you know, the Greater Israel movement over there in general. And there are a couple of elements to that. One is the rise of evangelical Protestantism, and particularly those evangelicals who are Christian Zionists, who believe that support for Israel, right or wrong, can be justified by Scripture. The other thing is there's this whole transnational network of political activists, both in international politics or, you know, foreign policy and defense and the neoconservatives, but also in domestic politics, who are going back and forth between Israel and Likud and the United States and the Republican Party, that represents some organic links between these two movements. And I think the net effect is that the Republican Party has become, you know, increasingly in lockstep, you know, with the Israeli right.
Well, just in closing, Michael Desch, isn't there also this small group of very wealthy Jewish American donors? Sheldon Adelson, we've mentioned before, but he's prominent, but there's a fellow out here that owns some casinos, Moskovitz, who spends a lot of money on West Bank settlements, the family that own Häagen-Dazs ice cream, and a bunch of other wealthy American Jewish American business people are really investing a ton of money. I mean, it's not just the Christian Zionists. It's the, some of the biggest donors in Romney's race, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are a lot of money bags, you know, who are very influential in both parties, and I think that there are some, you know, epitomized by Sheldon Adelson, who feel very strongly on the Israel issue. And I think that does make a difference, but I wouldn't overstate it. You know, I think, you know, the fact of the matter is most American Jews remain much more inclined towards the Democratic Party. And I think that they're more moderate on issues of U.S.-Israel relations than the Adelsons and the Moskowitzes of the world are. But nonetheless, if you can donate $100 million to a campaign, you get a seat at the table. There's no denying that.
Of course, the point to remember here is the extent to which the American Jewish community is largely liberal and votes Democratic, and that this is a minority position, but it's one that's backed up by a ton of money and by a lot of political activism.
Right. The thing, you know, that I think that's important, but I think it's important as part of the larger organic connections between, you know, the Republican Party or elements of the Republican Party and Likud and other right-wing political movements in Israel. So the net effect of all these things is mutually reinforcing, you know, to the extent that you know, the position that General Scowcroft and the first President Bush took, you know, about the loan guarantees and the Madrid process, you know, which was the center of gravity, I think, in the foreign policy establishment, you know, 20 years ago, is now a fringe position within the Republican Party and a sort of reflexive, you know, anything the current government of Israel wants is okay by me position now unfortunately defines the center of gravity among Republicans.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Desch.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Desch. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame and a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study. He's a member of the editorial board and associate editor of International Security and served as editor-in-chief of Security Studies. Before joining the faculty at Notre Dame, Professor Desch was the founding director of the Scowcroft Institute for International Affairs and was the first holder of the Robert M. Gates Chair in Intelligence and National Security Decision-Making at the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. He has an article at Foreign Affairs. Bibi's chutzpah, the Prime Minister crosses a red line. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. A quiet voice.